Hello, friends. Noah here with a quick announcement before the episode starts. This Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern, come see us live at Caveat in New York City for a science comedy show and science trivia showdown loosely inspired by urban wildlife. We'll be joined by urban ecologist Dr. Casey Lardner and Dr. Valentina Allawesome, as well as by comedy writer and performer Sam Corbin for deep dives on our next door neighbors, a habitat for hilarity, and trivia about why we can't have niche things. Get it? Like ecological niche thing? Whatever, okay. So please join us either in person at Caveat in New York or via live stream from wherever you are. You can get tickets at the link in the episode description or in our bio at Fax Machine Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter, or finally by going to www.caveat.nyc. Hope to see you all there and enjoy the episode.
Please welcome to the stage my favorite people on the face of the earth, Christina Gustavich, Kasia Patel, and Dr. Emily Costa. My name is Noah Guyberson, and I am one third of Fax Machine, a show by and for people who are curious about everything, but especially the things that make them laugh. In our show, we share the fascinating facts we've discovered and the larger stories behind them, concluding with a pub-style trivia quiz that is, as we like to say, loosely inspired by the theme. Tonight, our theme is Earth, and we are joined by the greatest guests in the entire world, Christina Gustavich and Kasia Patel. Yay! And what on earth? It says here, Dr. Emily Costa. Thank you so much for coming tonight to Christina and Kasia, and thank you for showing up once again, as you do every show, Emily, who is also a host of this show.
We should clarify, you just got your PhD, like, days ago.
This is worth celebrating.
Yeah, this isn't just a douchey thing she makes people do. Yeah.
I only say this because it's come up a few times on a few shows, so it wasn't days ago, it was months ago, and I swear, like, I'm not getting multiple PhDs, and I would not recommend that to anyone.
Even the one was a bit, maybe even more
the
than
one
recommend.
Maybe too much. Ask me in a month.
Yeah,
well, I think that's more recent than I got my PhD, which does not exist. So
a future PhD. Wow, maybe you're studying time travel. That could be amazing.
Ooh,
so thank you to the three of you for coming tonight. Christina, you are an earth scientist. You are also a performer and a science educator. So I guess what I want to ask you is, what is your favorite rock?
I'm so glad you asked, Noah. My favorite rock is limestone.
Give it up for limestone.
Yeah, that's right. Who else? Who else loves limestone?
The controversial choice we all
desired. I know.
Desired.
I know. A carbonate. Imagine. So I love limestone because it is formed underwater, but we find it on land. It tells the story of places that now we can walk on used to be deep beneath the ocean. And as it's forming in the ocean, it's sequestering carbon. So thanks, limestone, for taking carbon out of the atmosphere.
So I wanted to ask you about, so my favorite rock growing up in a classroom that like had some rocks that you could like touch and interact with. I'm just curious how you feel about this take as like a teacher. My favorite rock growing up was the salt rock.
I'm so stressed. Okay.
Yeah, well, okay. So in the classroom that I was a kindergartner, there was a big hunk of salt rock on a very accessible shelf, and every single child in the school licked it multiple times a day.
Yes. Yes.
Is that an experience that you recognize?
That is definitely an experience I recognize. Also, if you have carbonates like limestone in your classroom, you can tell they're carbonates by putting hydrochloric acid on it and it'll fizz. So you can try different minerals with this, and students will put it on the limestone, it'll fizz, but they'll also put it on the halite, on the salt one.
Uh-oh.
And then later lick it.
Gross.
Yeah, it's what stomach acid is made of. You will digest your own tongue if you lick the rock with the hydrochloric acid on it. And I told a kid this, and she said, okay, but I put hand sanitizer on.
But I will say, I like the way you just said, yeah, you know when your kids have hydrochloric acid? Like, that's a very normal thing that your child at home will have. Like, be careful, don't lick the salt.
Don't.
Okay. Kasha, you are a science journalist and also a stand-up comedian, but I wanted to ask you, as someone who is, you have covered a lot of like weather-related topics in your journalism career, so I just want to ask you at this moment in the show where we're supposed to do a little bit of small talk, how's the weather?
It's a lot colder today than I thought it was. Is that fair? Clap it up if you were surprised that it was cold. Yeah, I came up from Washington, D.C., and it's a lot warmer down there.
So the fact that it's colder up here today, is that good news for the climate?
Well, as you know, weather and climate are very different things.
Gasp.
The way that I like to say it is I was talking to my boyfriend who doesn't exist, and he said that I am like the weather because I'm hard to predict every day. And I told him he is like the climate because he's only getting worse.
Wow. All right. So with our, moving on from, wow, just inspiring small talk for me, the thing I am most worst at. For our first Earth-inspired story of the night, please welcome to the mic, Christina Gustavich.
One of the only things I love more than planet Earth are the people on it who create reality television. That's me. Do we have any Love is Blind fans? Amazing. Imagine my delight when in season 2, episode 5 of Love is Blind, aka the crossover event of the last 66 million years, aka Love is Mass Extinction. You know what? You don't have to imagine my delight. I will relive it in detail with you now. This story begins in the present with these two people, Deep Dee and Shake. You remember them. If you don't, now you know. Who matched in the pods and sight unseen got engaged to each other. When they got to meet in person, the show sent them here to Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, represented by the palm tree. So, like many people visiting the peninsula, they said, let's see some cenotes. What is a cenote? Well, I will let Shake give you his explanation first, then I'll give you mine.
I'm really pumped to show Deep the cenote. They're really, really vibey underground caves.
Yes, really, really vibey underground caves. But most cenotes form when underground water permeates and erodes limestone away, and this creates a water-filled cave. Then later on, when sea level changes, that causes the roof to collapse in, then you have a cave. And as water flows back through, that's going to create the features like stalactites and stalagmites. So they're not just isolated holes in the ground, but they are an interconnected system with water flowing through that you can't see because it's groundwater, and it creates a really unique ecosystem that exists only in the system of cenotes. The Mayans settled near cenotes because they were a reliable source of fresh water. The presence of Mayan art, pottery, jewelry, weapons, and human remains indicates that these were a sacred location for ritual sacrifice. During periods of drought, they may have sent people to this fate to appease the rain god, Shak. So people have always known, since we've discovered these things, that they are a special, sacred place. For example.
The last time I was at one was actually for a music festival that Diplo was at. Definitely a different type of cenote experience than the one we're going to today, but I'm excited.
Do you think that he is more excited for this or was more excited for the Diplo concert?
I think he was more excited for the Diplo concert.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe that was his first cenote, which is objectively exciting.
Are they letting them go to these cenotes to sin? Oh, fuck, sorry.
Yes?
You clearly don't know what happens with the two of them. There was no sinning going on there.
I actually have never seen this show. What is implied that's going to happen at the cenote?
Okay, so to run it back regarding Love is Blind, so they date in the pods and they talk to each other, but they can't see or touch each other. It's only their voices, and they can only meet after they get engaged.
Okay.
So they go on these exotic adventures. And so I guess it's implied that it's all very sexy.
Okay.
It's so like confession with the priest.
But sexy.
Equally sexy.
Yeah.
Daddy, forgive me, for I have sinned. Is that, I'm not Catholic either, so.
Me either.
Can someone confirm?
Right. That sounds right.
Is that what happens at church?
Oh, Papa, please forgive me. Right? Is that better? I don't know.
So maybe it's a sexy
Please
sin
go
thing.
On.
Okay, no, I was just deciding how into Catholicism we should get. Okay, so. What?
More church jokes.
More!
They want more church jokes. The people have spoken.
I don't have those. Okay.
The papal have spoken. Is that good enough?
There we go.
Cool.
I don't know. Great. Okay. So Shake is stoked about this cenote. He's going to show Deepti the cenote. The last time he was at one, Diplo concert. Great. But at this point, I'm watching this, and I'm like, Shake, would you be as excited if you knew that these cenotes formed during an event that wiped out 75% of the animal species on Earth? That's right. The cenotes in the Yucatan Peninsula are associated with an asteroid impact, the famous one that killed off the dinos 66 million years ago. Evidence for this can be found all over the planet. So this picture is from Spain. This is showing the KPG, meaning the Cretaceous Paleogene boundary. So below that line is times before the asteroid impact. Above that line are times after the asteroid impact. So here it is more up close. It's a layer of clay found in many places throughout planet Earth that contains relatively high levels of iridium, which is not typical of Earth's crust, but is typical of asteroids. Geologists love to touch. It's a multi-sensory discipline. I invite everyone to get into it. So here are some other impact craters. On the left, from the moon. On the right, from Arizona. And for the podcast listeners, let me tell you, they are round. Knowing this shape is unique to planetary surfaces that have been hit by asteroids creating the craters, you have to have a second look at the Yucatan cenote map and say, holy shit.
Holy, got it.
Holy.
Got it.
I didn't even do that on purpose. So the cenotes that make up this ring are called, ready for a science term, ring cenotes.
Unexpected.
I know. Because they show where the outer ring of the impact crater is. So rather than a collapse of the roof from a changing sea level, the roofs of these collapsed because a 15 kilometer wide asteroid hit the ocean nearby, or what is now the ocean nearby. So if we were to remove all of the soil and water, this is what we'd see. Once again, round. So this is showing a gravity anomaly, meaning the different colors are representing, for our purposes, different rock types. Same data, just with a little more detail here, showing that the rock types that we would normally find in the middle are not, because they have been spewed into the atmosphere, preventing photosynthesis and causing a mass extinction event over about the next 10,000 years. Side note, I think especially with the asteroid that killed the dinos, we think of mass extinction events as like a one-time thing, like everybody got hit on the head with a meteor. But they're really long, drawn-out events, and all of them throughout Earth's history can be traced back to some sort of climate change.
I have a question for you as a geologist.
Yes.
How do you feel? I've heard that some people think the asteroid didn't quite kill the dinosaurs, that they were already kind of dying because of like big volcanic type gassing that made it really cool in the atmosphere. What's your opinion about volcanoes versus asteroids?
This is really like a weather versus geology.
Yeah,
I'm coming for you.
They work together. Yeah, that is possible. Or I mean, that was also happening. It was, you know, you see like the dinosaur lunchbox and it always has the volcano on it.
Yeah.
Earth was more volcanically active during the dino times, so I think it's not inaccurate to draw that conclusion. I think the evidence suggests that it wasn't the only thing that would have caused death on this scale.
Nice. I got it.
Nice. Let's check back in with our couple. We haven't seen them for a minute.
I love going out and doing things. Deep seems to be that type of person, too.
Yes. Two people who like going out and doing things.
Can really feel their connection.
Yeah.
Can really feel
Noah
it.
Noah doesn't know what happened with this couple.
No, I assume they lived separately ever after, unlike the dinosaurs.
It's like the most, I don't even watch the show, and it came to me.
Wow.
Should we say what happened, or are you going to go over that?
I think it'll be revealed.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay. Can't wait.
Yeah, so.
I hear wedding bells.
The only thing less compatible than two people who simply love going out and doing things is an asteroid and 75% of life on Earth. They broke up at the altar. Thank
no!
you.
Thank you so much. All right, guys, we're going to have to go real fast. I have like 8 minutes to explain how I think the universe works. All right, so this is going to be about GPS, galaxies, and gravity. I feel qualified to talk about this because not only am I a stand-up comedian, but I also took some physics classes twice, and I almost went to medical school if I applied. So this is going to be great. Clap it up if we have physics people in here. Oh, this is great. You guys know everything. You guys are obnoxious to your friend group is what I'm learning. Okay, great, great. Okay, so my journey, everyone's journey, starts with this guy here. This is Isaac Newton. And despite his hair, he is actually has a lot of things in common with us. He's very relatable. He was actually never married. Where my single people at? Never married. And that checks out. It's the same group. It's fine. He never married, and he lived until he was 86 years old. They also think he was a virgin. Woo! And also, he lived through a pandemic. His pandemic, he was a little more productive. During my pandemic, I just tried being more productive than COVID. I think the first year, COVID produced about like 5 different strands, and I read about 3 book introductions. So I wasn't successful, but he was way more successful. During this time when he was quarantined and had to be home, he came up with the seeds of calculus and also gravity, which is what I'm going to talk about today. You might recognize this picture of this tree. This is not a random tree. This is a descendant of the famous tree. As legend goes, he saw an apple fall down, and he is like, what is gravity? Which was also him playing Jeopardy very, very early on, foreshadowing the best background TV show of all time. Now, what he said was gravity is this force between two objects, is an attraction, but he said gravity in his world only came through a flat, uniform space. So basically, if you drop an apple, it falls down in a straight line. When he said this, people went apeshit. They were so excited. They're like, this is the Enlightenment. We know how everything works. We know how Earth works. We know also how the motion of the planets around Earth works. We found Neptune because of this theory. But there was one thing that didn't quite make sense. And this was Mercury, the orbit of Mercury. The orbit of Mercury was just a little weird because it looked like it was doing okay, but then it just had this like really, really small wobble that would throw it off about 43 arc seconds once a century. That was for that table right there. Hey. So what happened is, this discrepancy between what Newton calculated Mercury's orbit should be, precession of orbit, was a little off from what they actually observed. And they couldn't figure out why is Mercury weird. So they came up saying like, well, let's think about this. Maybe there is another planet between the Sun and Mercury. And thus started the hunt for planet Vulcan, which is a very real thing that people put in papers to search for it. But now, exactly how do you find a planet or any kind of body really, really close to the sun when the sun is so bright that it washes it out? This is how, and I want everyone to say it with me. A total solar eclipse! Hey, we just had one of those. How fun! How fun! So they did that for so many people tried looking for planet Vulcan from a total solar eclipse, and they never found it. And some people are like, whatever, forget it. But some people are like, no, this is like really bothersome for me. And one of those people was this guy. You might know this guy as Albert Einstein. He is best known for his theoretical use of a comb. And if you don't believe me, this is what the internet told me he once said. Long hair minimizes need for barbers. Socks can be done without. One leather jacket solves the coat problem for many years. Suspenders are superfluous. So he knew what his hair looked like.
And also, I think his pants kept falling down. So Einstein is such a fascinating person. I know that sounds so cliche to say, but you probably don't know how fascinating he was. He was quite a ladies' man. You should read about him later. But what I want to tell you about is this is a young Albert Einstein. So he went to college for physics, but then he couldn't find a job as a professor, which shows you that the job market has always sucked. But a family friend gave him a job as a patent examiner. A patent examiner. That is like a chemistry major, me, doing stand-up comedy to make money. Like, it's very not the same thing at all.
It's also really interesting that somebody just had patent examiner jobs to give out. Like, I would assume that requires, like, a little bit of qualification and understanding of patent and trademark law, maybe.
Well, this was him pulling strings with the person he did know, and they're like, I have a patent examiner job. There's a Hulu series called Genius, and it goes over his life. And in the series, I don't know if it's right, because I don't have time to fact check it, but he paid someone to do his patent examining duties so he could actually work on special relativity while he was doing it. So anyways, what happens is he comes up with E equals MC squared at 26 years old. But it doesn't make him famous. In fact, it doesn't really do much. Other physics people know who he is, and then he finally gets a job as a professor. 10 years later, as a 36-year-old, he comes up with this idea that can address what Newton's gravity did not. He calls it the theory of general relativity, or general theory of relativity. He publishes 1915, and still, nobody's like, no one really is that excited about it. Because this thing is so weird. People read it and like, what the heck are you thinking, Einstein? And this is what it said. Instead of Newton that said gravity comes in a flat uniform space, he says, what if space and time are linked together and it's curved? It can be warped and twisted and pulled by an object or matter. And this is like a pretty wild thing. They're like, we need proof. He's like, I'm a theoretical physicist. That's not my thing. But he said, if someone else wants to do this, what you can do is chart the position of the stars near the sun, and then take away the sun and chart the position of the stars when the sun's not there. Ideally, it should move, because when the sun's there, it will bend starlight around it. And then when the sun's not there, the starlight shouldn't be as bent as much. He even measured this, this deflection. But again, how do you look at stars in the middle of the day next to the sun? How can you do that? Let's say it again. It's a total solar eclipse. You guys are so smart. So doing this experiment was actually pretty hard. A lot of people did it. They failed. There was clouds in the way. One group, it was during World War I, they tried going to Crimea, and their instruments got confiscated by the Russians. It was like a lot of different things that happened.
When was this? Sounds like it could have been recently.
History repeats itself. All right, next. But there was this group of British astronomers, Arthur Eddington and Frank Dyson, who came across this, and they finally figured out in 1919. This is 4 years after Einstein published his theory. And this is their paper. I suggest you can read it. There's a lot of unnecessary detail in it, which makes it fun. There's one line that I really liked. I'm sure they meant it in a very neutral way, but this is the way I read it. Evidently, the observation must be made during a total eclipse of the sun. I like to think of them as sassy. So what they did is they actually found this. This is a picture of a total solar eclipse, and those lines are the stars that they actually measured, and they could actually see, hey, there's deflection going on here. This is a better, more high-res picture of it. Same data, just processed more, and these circles are the stars and stuff. So what happened is they found about 14 different stars were three different data sets. One data set did not fall with Einstein's number, so they're just like, eh, we don't need that one. The other two did fall under Einstein's number, but there was such a large margin of error, but they're like, ah, who cares? Einstein's right. So then that's what they pronounced, and this was on the front of the New York Times. Einstein theory triumphs. Stars not where they seemed or where calculated to be, but nobody need worry.
I love that.
And I just like that newspapers were hyping their headlines even way back then.
Men of science, more or less agog.
Who's to say?
How can you be less agog? That's like a pretty extreme emotion.
Okay. Honestly, I'm fascinated by negotiations with Belgium over territorial adjustments are said to be going well.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that.
French government to open cheap national restaurants. I like how that is right next to lights askew in the heavens. Yeah. Seems pretty accurate for
Nobody
today.
Nobody need worry.
Anyway, so this was the experiment that everyone knew who Einstein was. He got catapulted into fame. When they say, you're no Einstein, they got that douchey statement because of this experiment. This is when he became worldwide famous. And the internet told me that he didn't really like this. This is something he might have said. The English expedition of 1919 is ultimately to blame for this whole misery by which the general masses seized possession of me. Ever since, I have become a kind of flag that various sorts of interests parade about, which indicates to me that he would have hated my talk right now. Way too much attention. But the interesting thing is he did win the Nobel Prize in 1921, a few years after this, but he did not win the Nobel Prize for any of his gravity stuff. No special relativity, no general relativity. There are a lot of weird things that were going on. For one, that his theory was just like so weird that they were like, we need more observational evidence. And two, there was a lot of anti-Semitism going on because of World War II. So they ended up giving it, so they kept deferring his Nobel Prize. They finally gave it to him for something he did like in 1905 with the photoelectric effect before he even came up with anything about any of his gravity theories. But it was fine because he had some XYs he needed to pay, so that's the Nobel Prize money was very, very helpful. So in this past total solar eclipse, people are actually still recreating this experiment. And I highly recommend that you read this, Washington Post, why this eclipse could really show Einstein was correct. It's a good article. I would know because I wrote it. And it's just like really cool because what they're trying to do is find stars really, really, really close to the sun. There's this idea that sometimes people think that original 1919 Eddington experiment wasn't good enough because they pick stars really far away from the sun and you can't really see that much deflection. So what these group of researchers and students did, they picked it in the forbidden zone, really, really close to the sun. And you can see, because there's some pretty crazy stuff that happens, and it just shows you the process of science. So now what does this have to do with us? We hear Einstein's theory of general relativity. Maybe you understand it from what I said. But how does this apply to us? Well, this is actually the biggest application of general relativity is through our GPS systems. So you have a clock on Earth and you have a clock in space and they move at different speeds. The clocks here on are because of a different gravitational strength, the field of gravitation. So on Earth, the clock actually moves slower than it will in space. So if you have your little Google Maps, the signal's going to be off because you might be moving a little faster here on Earth. And when you get that signal from space, it's going to tell you to turn left and there's not going to be something to turn left. So satellite companies actually have to use Einstein's theory of general relativity to compensate for this. Sometimes they can make it lead a little slower or faster to make sure that you are connected so that way you can leave Caveat home safely using your GPS. And that is all.
We are here now to give you the results of the trivia, which you have all done on your tables. A lot of enjoyment, a lot of enthusiasm for the trivia. That is actually not typical. I'm glad to hear the adjustments I've made in terms of fairness and, quote, bullshit have been appreciated. So the time has come for the trivia results. Our guests did the same trivia that you did. Let's find out how they did. Please welcome back to the stage Christina, Kasha, and Em. Outstanding. All right, so Christina, hello. Kasha, Em, how do you feel about the trivia? Do you feel on top of the world, or is this hell on Earth?
Call me the Arctic Circle.
Because
you're on fire.
Okay, you've once again witnessed how incredibly good I am at talking. Well, folks, the trivia answers. Question one, Point Nemo is the location on the surface of the Earth that is farthest away from what?
Okay, I really confidently answered this one fast, okay. So if it's wrong, it's not my teammate's fault, so I'm owning it. I think it's the point on Earth that's farthest away from land.
That is absolutely correct.
Woohoo!
It seems like pretty generally people have heard of Point Nemo.
No, I thought it was special.
That's great. Point Nemo is the location, as you say, on Earth farthest away from any other land. It's also where we like deliberately crash a lot of spacecraft because it's like, I guess, less likely to hit stuff. And so it is this place in the South Pacific, and you can see sort of that radius there with one point being Antarctica and 2 points being these islands up there, off, I guess, pretty far off the coast of Peru. So that's Point Nemo. So question two, true or false, after a volcano erupts, new land can be created when magma flows down the slope of the volcano and cools.
False.
All right, false. Why do you say that?
Well, we said because it's lava.
That is absolutely correct. Could you, for anybody in the room who's confused, can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's magma if it's underground. It's lava when it comes out. That's it.
So I didn't fully eliminate the bullshit that I... certainly less. You can't deny that there's less, all right? So yes, the answer, of course, is that, you know, when lava comes out of a volcano and then cools, that is a way new land can happen. But magma, it ceases to be magma when it comes out of the volcano.
But also, like, a volcano eruption can lead to, like, new land and new islands. That happened with the Tonga volcano.
Yeah.
Happened in January 2022. January 16th, 2022.
Wow.
A volcanic eruption in off the coast of the island of Tonga erupted. And it was the most powerful volcanic explosion since Krakatoa.
Wow.
And it set a sonic boom around the Earth twice.
Whoa. Sometimes also when volcanoes erupt, they just explode and then there's no more island.
That's
which is
also true.
Interesting.
The volcanoes giveth and the volcanoes taketh away.
That's right.
As they say.
Incredible button to put on the end of that one. So let's move on to question three. Wilde's Monster Globe was a 60-foot, 4-inch wide spherical scale model of Earth built so the entire surface could be viewed without walking around to the other side. How was this achieved?
Okay, so we went around a couple times with this one.
No, you don't have to go around. That's the.
Yes, thank you. And we figured, just imagining the size and scope of it, that this monster globe was something you could walk into and stand in one place and maybe rotate, but not walk. Those are different things. And see the entire globe.
The answer, in fact, was that you are correct. You
Good.
Could go inside it.
Yeah.
The globe was hollow and the surface could be viewed from inside. So this
inside.
Is what it looked like from the outside. It was built incredibly quickly for way more money than was projected and for way less money than it should have been. And this is what it basically, like a cross-section of what
cool.
it looked like. So, yes, so the guy Wilde who made this was like a geographer and I guess like cartographer and made like, while it was being built, was just like in his workshop near King's Cross. That's why I said station. Or maybe St. Pancras. It's one of the train stations. That's the only thing I remembered from it. And he was like making every bit of this in plaster of Paris with all the mountains and rivers and then like hand painted. I think some other craftspeople were in on that too. And so like if you read articles from the time, they're like blown away by like the fact that little volcanoes had like a tiny little dot of like red paint on them to indicate that they were active. They also said in some cases, you know, obviously pre-satellite times, they were just like unknown regions of the Earth are sort of just beige and like not really detailed. And another one that I loved was in this article about it. They said something like, if you give an ordinary man an inch, he'll take 10 miles. But in this case, that was the exact scale of the model that was done. So they had a little fun with that.
That's so
of course.
Fun.
Yeah. Wait, so does this not exist anymore?
No, it was torn down about like, I think like 11 or 12 years.
Why?
So, because the lease, I think that was the like term of the lease. He actually built it. He
what?
Built it.
Yeah. What a nightmare of a tenant.
Yeah. No, you know, he
they
was.
They left a globe.
He genuinely was a nightmare tenant. And so it was basically he, in order to let him do this, I think it was in the Leicester Square Garden. That's not a train station. Or maybe it is. I think it's a, it doesn't
You
matter.
Just have all the British, do you have any more British locations for us?
Yeah.
Cockwobble or nice. Something like that.
I believe it.
I don't know if that's real, but it should be. So basically he in order to get permission to build this like on the grounds of this like gardens, he had to promise that he would restore the gardens when he left, but he just fucking refused and then he left and they couldn't get him to do it. So he built this and then it went into disrepair and was torn down, which is a bummer because it's a pretty incredible thing. Question four. A man was arrested in Chile for stealing nearly 6 tons of ice from a rapidly receding Patagonian glacier. For what use did he intend to sell it?
Okay, we, I think, have been to our fair share of, like, a disappointing cocktail bar.
Okay.
Where they have, like, a gimmick.
Yeah.
So I think... I went to one the other day. It was giving the Glasgow Willy Wonka experience of cocktail bars. You guys, it was called the Rose Room, and it made it look like a whole garden, but it's like a corner of the Hudson Yards Mall, and you can't see outside, and the roses aren't real. Anyway, save your money. We think this guy was going to put it in drinks.
That is absolutely correct.
Yay!
He was...
For cocktails!
The intent was to... he basically stole about nearly 6 tons of ice from one of the most, like, vulnerable glaciers in the world. He was arrested driving a refrigerated truck, basically, back to then carve it up for sale as sort of designer ice cubes for, like, cocktails. Sort of the rationale for this, supposedly, is that something having to do with the pressures and stuff that this ice is under, there's maybe, like... less bubbles or impurities or whatever they want to sell you this bullshit. And that is bad enough. There actually have been a lot of companies more recently that are trying to take, like, iceberg ice. So, like, you know, recently calved ice that's going down. And so, like, climate scientists who are, like, interviewed about this say, like, it's not really that big of a deal. I would say that it is a big deal, not necessarily because losing that particular ice or putting in a drink halfway across the world once it's already in the water is that big of a deal for climate change, but it's that it creates a market for somebody to go to a land glacier and try to steal ice when they can't get to a like a water glacier or don't have the resources to go get it.
Just lie.
So just don't. Yeah, just regular ice, guys.
It's ice. You could tell me it's from a glacier, and I would pay you $21
for just the ice.
Just the ice.
New York, am I right?
Could I put y'all on the spot? And if y'all were ice sommeliers, how would you describe your ice?
Like the ideal ice.
You're trying to sell ice for $21 pre-drink price. A $21 douche cube. How do you sell that?
I would say mine is warm.
Whoa. It doesn't go cold.
It's warm ice. And you're going to buy it to figure out if I'm lying. And then you'll figure out that I'm lying. But I already got your money.
So who wants some glacier ice? Yeah.
Warm glacier ice.
I don't have an answer, but can I do like a French language check in the audience? Is gelée ice in French?
No.
Darn. I was trying to make a pun, and I rescind it. Thank you.
It's for the best. Glass.
Glass. Ah. Oh, cool. Well. Small gelée does not work, then.
Oh. Well, good try. We love that. Just say it loud into your mic anyway, and we'll change the dictionary.
Cool. Thank you.
All right. So question five. True or false, when an ice sheet melts, the nearby sea levels drop because the seawater is no longer gravitationally attracted to the ice.
All right. We have an answer, but now that you've read it out loud, I don't know. You said false.
It is, in fact, true. Ice sheets are so goddamn big that they actually exert a gravitational effect on the water, like the seawater nearby, and essentially, like, pulls it up the coast, or up the, I guess, beach or coastline, whatever. So as you lose mass in this glacier, you get local sea level fall, even though, as that water goes into the ocean, you get a global increase in the average sea level. The effect on the sea level locally is that it goes down, but has a greater effect on the sea level rise elsewhere. And so one of the things that is interesting as a consequence of this is that when the Antarctic ice sheet melts, or, you know, continues to melt, one of the places that will experience the most rise in sea level is the United States, precisely because of how far away from it is. I actually learned in these articles the place that might experience the most rise in sea level is actually Washington, D.C., where Kasha lives. So sorry to break that to you.
That's okay. You guys got problems here in New York.
That's true. So question six, another true or false question. The methane emitted by cattle flatulence amounts to approximately 3.7% of all greenhouse gas emissions. True or false?
So we said false because we think you used some tricky wording here.
Are you suggesting that there's some bullshit involved in this cow flatulence-based question?
Maybe 3.7%. But but yeah, so we say false.
The answer is true.
No! Wait, no, we said true. Wait,
no, it's false.
Wait, we did say true.
Fucked it up. I'm sorry.
No, wait, we actually said true.
We said true.
We said true.
We actually said true.
I forgot, and they both were circled. But true has two circles, so therefore that's the answer.
Because we said false, we and
said,
then we...
Yeah, we said, we initially thought false because we misread it, and we thought you meant of all methane, and then we're like, no, 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 all greenhouse gases.
All
that makes sense, and 3.7 is a little too specific for you to think to
okay.
make up.
The number is right. The place it's emitted from is wrong.
Not the butt?
The answer is false. I just screwed up the slide. I
oh,
apologize.
It's, what?
The answer
what we said false. Aren't
they? They yeah, burp out of the methane.
We said false.
The vast
so
majority of methane. Wait, so which one did you say?
We said false. Which
one? Okay, then it's true. No, the vast majority of methane emitted by cows comes from, I think it's called enteric fermentation that just happens in their stomach and then they burp it out. So people are trying to come up with different kinds of feed. They're trying to like put in, I guess, enzymes that change the amount of like methane that's produced. They're coming up with a whole lot of ideas to like try to make this like huge source of greenhouse gas emissions as like a singular source reduced. So hopefully that will come come before it's too late. But it probably won't.
There's also some scientists in Europe that are collecting cow urine. They're going to collect it and then
you gotta
they
have hobbies.
Strike it. They strike it with like really high-powered lasers, like striking with lightning, to make it no longer like the methane emission. So that's one way that they're trying to do it.
Interesting. So they're saying how do they collect the cow feces?
Oh,
before?
There's a video. And you should definitely look it up.
Okay.
The cow is in a cage, not a cage. It's like a green, there's green on the bottom, right? And then it just like pees and you can hear it pee, it pees. And then it's kind of like a pool table, right? It just kind of goes in a little corner and it gets collected that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Question 7. Earth is within our sun's circumstellar habitable zone, sometimes referred to by the name of what character from a 19th century British fairy tale featuring an impudent old woman and 3 bachelors?
That it's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's the Goldilocks zone.
That is absolutely correct. I was attempting a little bit of bullshit because I do think that a lot of people know the circumstellar habitable zone is known as the Goldilocks zone. I don't think that a lot of people know the original story of Goldilocks was with some like delinquent old woman breaking into the house of 3 bachelors called Bears, who are just roommates, and then just going nuts. This story changed a bunch of times, as you would imagine, over the course of the 19th century and to the story that we now know. And in originally what was known as the like original story, the woman sort of like wrecks their home and then jumps out a window when the 3 bachelor bears come home. And subsequently, I believe an earlier version of it was found where the bears murder her. Like a lot, like in that sort of 19th century fairy tale kind of murder. Like there was put on a spike and like roasted and all kinds of other stuff. That's the canon version I will be telling my children.
I personally thought it was Harry Potter. I thought it was like Professor McGonagall with Harry, Ron, and Draco.
Yeah, that would also describe this.
3 bachelors.
Yeah.
So the last question of the night. Question 8, which of the following minerals did I make up? A, taconite. B, eureka dumpite. C, coming tonight. D, busy tonight. Or E, well, shite. Telling a little story, I think, with these.
Tell a story with these?
Yeah, no, I'm saying they are sort of in the order of the story.
Yeah. We thought it was busy tonight.
Busy tonight?
Yes.
No, is fake.
But okay.
Totally correct.
Scared me.
Taco night is real.
That
Eureka dumpite is real.
Over here.
Coming tonight is real. Welshite is real. These typically are just named after like the places they're discovered. So I believe Welshite is maybe just from somewhere in like a mine in Wales.
Welsh-it.
Coming tonight is from Cummington, Massachusetts, I believe. Yeah. Eureka dumpite.
Sure.
There's a dump in that town or nearby, and they just named a mineral they found there Eureka Dumpite. And then Taco Night, I believe is some place like Toconia or something like that. Unfortunately, was not sort of what was left over after all the free tacos from 3 or 4 days after. Did anyone go to college bars? There was like, my memory of it, I don't know if this is like a relatable experience, on Friday, so they would have taco night on Tuesday, and then on Friday they would have free tacos. And you could just go there and eat the 4 day old, whatever, tacos. And that got me through school. So I don't know if you can tell based on the way that I am now, you know.
Didn't you like go to a good university?
Not one that could afford fresh tacos. Body by old tacos. So this is the end of our trivia for tonight, and so I'm going to read you a couple of the winners. So we have the team that scored the highest in the audience. That was Soup Girls with 6 out of 8. They are the winner. Congratulations. And then at Fax Machine, we don't just give an award to the team that scored the most points. We also give an award to the team that we like to say learned the most. And that is, I believe this says, the Patologas, who got in. Who learned everything for the first time tonight. And I would just like to say thank you so much for coming. We hope you will come back. And next time, if we have these exact same questions, you're gonna get a perfect score. We also have an honorable team name mention here for Shaken, Not Stirred.
Hey.
I guess a Love Island reference. So
love
thank you.
Love is blind.
Love Island. Noah. Sorry. Love is blind. Wait, which? It is Love is Blind,
blind.
Right? Okay, sorry.
Yes. Yeah.
And then we also have Team Earth Lovers, parenthesis, thank you, Limestone.
Yay! Yeah. Where are you? Where are the Earth Lovers? Thank you, Limestone. Yay!
Suck ups.
I have no power here.
Well, folks, that's just about all we have for you tonight. Thank you so much to all of you for coming out. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this show, which it's... Oh, great, you did. That's a big relief. If you enjoyed this show, I hope you'll follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at Fax Machine Pod, and go listen to, rate, and subscribe to Fax Machine wherever you listen to podcasts. And also, please come hang out with us at the after party, because we'd love to meet you and hear what brought you here and what you like.
But, or tell us your favorite rock.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about rocks.
Christina, just out of curiosity, do you have anything you'd like to plug? We have your social media right here.
My face, yeah. Find me on the socials. I don't have anything specific to plug right now, but I'm cooking up something for you, and I'll announce it there.
Hell yeah. Ooh. Go follow Christina. And Kasha, anything for you?
Just follow me on stuff. I do science comedy nights in Washington, D.C., so if you're down there, come hang. And then also, I turn my articles into fun science videos that you can watch for under a minute. I'm piling them up right now, then I'll put them all out one day for the rest of my life.
Amazing. So please give it up for our guests one more time, Christina Gustavich and Kasha Patel. We do this show right here at Caveat on the third Thursday of every month. So that means our next show is Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. You can join us for a science comedy show and science trivia showdown loosely inspired by the non-humans of New York. We're looking forward to deciding once and for all what the greatest of New York's animals it is and why, in my opinion, it is the resplendent city pigeon. Ooh. So from here, all of us here at Fax Machine, this is our favorite place to be on the entire earth. And each and every moment we've spent here with you, we've been on top of the world. Thank you so much for coming out tonight, and see you next month.
Yay! Thank you.